This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hi, my name is Deep Tran. I am a third generation chef, restaurateur. I'm a worker, labor rights activist and advocate. Most recently, I co-wrote the Red Boat Fish Sauce Cookbook with Gung Pham and Thin Nguyen.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
You and I did a podcast a few weeks ago, and this discussion of the first question that I asked came up, and I have since then really put some thought into asking the question of what does it mean to be Vietnamese to our guests. But now I'm going to change it up, and I have been changing it up in different ways, but how has it changed for you in your life up until this point?
I think your one's understanding of one's own identity, I think, changes with, like, you know, some sort of pivotal moment, just like it, you know, like significant moments in your life, you know, where things that change. Like, first of all, you know, like, when I was in Vietnam, I didn't think, oh, what's it like to be Vietnamese, because just living my five-year-old life, you know, or even in the refugee camp, you know. I think that changed when you come to the, when I came to the U.S. and I realized, oh, they don't speak the same language as I do. Why are we getting, like, a very low level hate crime all the time in the neighborhood, when I was a kid, you know, the main theme when I came to the U.S. was like, wow, Nami, they're very wasteful, you know, like, they waste everything. Like, everything is, like, disposable. And, you know, like, even, like, taking a shower, like, the first time I saw a commercial for, I think it was Irish Spring. Right. And they were like, the shower's going, and they're just like soaping up. And we're like, oh my God, don't, you know, how new of it, you know? Cause, like, well, what did we do, right? We put in a bucket and then we have a little scoop. Mm. And then, you know, that's how you would bathe. So the idea of just, like, oh wow, these, like, they're just running that water, like, forever and lathering up. So, like, you know, that was, like, felt very different. I go, you know, so I understood, like, those are gonna be me, and then we're not gonna be, you know. Or, like, when I for a long time, you know, we'd always we'd come home from, like, going out somewhere, probably Little Saigon, we'd come back to the house, and our house was full of teepee. You're just, and we're like, they're so wasteful. Like, they join you, my hat, they join you, right? But we didn't know it was like a low level hate crime. Like, they right. hated us. We're just like, wow, they're like, Americans are so rich, they could just waste toilet paper. So, but, you know, like, so yeah, I think it changes. Like, you know, I think before I kind of really understood what was going on, I just thought, like, you know, we were very thrifty. You know, like, I understood that Vietnamese people are very thrifty compared to, yeah, like, white people, Americans, or just Americans in general, just American born, you know. And then the first time I kind of realized it was, like, some animosity was when, you know, we used to go dumpster diving on trash day, you know, like, we'd go and we're like, oh my gosh, you know, here's a sewing machine, perfectly good. You know, maybe it just needs to be oiled up or whatever. And we never bought a new sewing machine. Like, we always bought a took a sewing machine from the dumpster, you know. And then one time a cousin of mine came home completely bloodied because some of the neighborhood kids were beating him up because they said that they were, you know, like that they were stealing their trash. I'm like, dude, it's your fucking trash. Yeah, you know. And then but we handled it because there were 15 of us.
Okay, but how did you have wait, yeah. I can't let you go. Wait, how did you handle it? Handle it.
I mean, we just browbeat him because I think he thought that it was just this one kid and no one's around, but then they didn't realize our 5-bedroom house was full of 5 families. You know what I mean? It wasn't like, like every house, every bedroom was an apartment. So they were like 15 kids. So, you know.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Cerritos.
Got it.
I lived on the same street as Lindsay Wagner's brother. So that's a little, the bionic woman. Anyway, so we didn't, no one threw a punch, but all 15 of us like went to, like asked the cousin, who's the guy? And we just browbeat him and he got freaked out because one didn't know what we were gonna do, but none of us ever threw a punch.
Wow.
And then same thing happened to my other little cousin when she went to kindergarten. She was one of her younger cousins. And then she came home crying. She said, they're so mean and they pushed her around. And so 50 of us went to elementary school and say, and browbeat like a kindergartner. Like, so I guess it was intimidation, I guess, you know, but yeah, like we stood up, but none of us really, I don't remember any punches being thrown.
But like you arrived in Cerritos and you grew up in Cerritos basically, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know, Cerritos is between Orange County and LA kind of, right? It's basically between it. I think it's
geographically LA, but it's more culturally akin to Orange County.
Correct.
That's kind of, yeah.
Correct. That's a perfect description of Cerritos. When I think about those in-between cities between LA and Orange County, it's very special because you kind of get to share a unique combination of, because they're very different cities ways of growing up, Orange County and LA, and to live in like a Downey or Cerritos, mm-hmm. or those kind of neighborhoods it's unique, and it's, you can go to both cities fairly easy, 20 minutes each way, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think like, you know, when people say like, oh, I grew up in Little Saigon, I think more people actually grew up going to Little Saigon, you know, but living in Long Beach, you know, living in Norwalk, you know, like Artesia and Cerritos, like, you know, like, but, you know, where did we culturally, like we spent our time wasn't necessarily in our residence, the city of our residence, but more like, you know, we would go like, you know, since, you know, I think Little Saigon developed, I would say, you know, I think even like 79, it had a little bit of something like the 80s, and then 82 right. is really when it popped off. Was, you know, we'd like, you know, every weekend was the Bonsa, right? We didn't call Little Saigon, we called Bonsa, right?
Bonsa.
And like, you know, like, what do you want from Bonsa? Like, I want a bun bab, I want a jingle lord, I want a, like you kind of pre-game because you only go once a week, you know? And then my grandparents made jalua, you know? That was their side hustle. So like, you know, they would go to Nam Hua was an OG. I still love Nam Hua for their frozen jiazao that they make. It's the best, you know, jiazao gua, right? And so like, you know, they would like buy like 50, 100 pounds of, you know, teak jiao to make a jalua at home because they had like the buffalo chopper.
Yeah.
To make jiazao. I mean, like a lot of people, I mean, that's kind of like after, you know, my grandparents did it first. And then when a new relative would come, you know, it was during the ODP time where like one day you just get a phone call and go, hey, Buck Bike is at the airport with his kids, you know, I'm like, ooh, Buck Bike? Oh, okay. You know, and all of a sudden a whole new family comes and, you know, and you got no notice. And so, but when Buck Bike's family came, they're like, okay, we already got business for you, Lam Jiazaodi, you know, Jialuodi, right? So they would make Jialuodi, like, and then, you know, and Buck Hong would come and like, hey, you knew you don't got the restaurant not set up for you yet, Lam Jialuodi, you know, it's like that buffalo chopper like traveled, you know?
Yeah. Can you tell us what a buffalo chopper is for people who don't know?
A buffalo chopper is the crazy ass. It's like a food processor, but you know when I know a lot of people are just afraid of that little blade that they have in a food processor, like a Cuisinart. Just imagine that, but like 10 times as big. So it's fucking crazy, and it's like no children should be around it, but we were around it all the time and washing it and stuff. Like, it was just just like it almost like looks like a mini jet propeller. You know, like jet engine blade, you know. So kind of like, you know what it was? It's like you know, that Indiana Jones, that really racist one with Short Round, and some guy got killed because he got caught into a blade of like a ceiling fan. It was like that, you know. That's how, yeah. So that was a buffalo chopper, and you need that to grind the jet lua, unless you were OG and then you want to pound it. But who the hell's doing that, you know, in the US?
My grandmother lost two of her fingers in
Oh.
that buffalo chopper.
Oh my God. Yeah, so it's
She
like,
made jello, yeah, when she was in Vietnam, and yeah, they
oh my
lost her fingers.
God. Oh gosh. Okay, I'm about to faint because I was like, yeah, because it's really scary. So like a, you know, as an 8-year-old, you're like, the fuck, I don't want to help grandma. You know, can I do anything else but that? But even it was scary because like my grandparents, when I met them, they were, you know, like in their 60s already. So I always thought they're gonna die anyway. So I'm like, oh my God, you're around this. It's just like seems so dangerous. But they're, you know, grandma was like fucking fearless. So, you know, yeah.
So when you were growing up, what did you want to do?
You know, when I was growing up, I had already had a plan. I wanted to become an English professor. I just want, because I love English literature, and I just wanted to read, you know, Victorian literature and Regency Jane Austen literature, and that's what I wanted to do, and poetry, and so that's, you know, I didn't kind of care about any other subjects, but I really loved English, and it began because we were foster kids because my parents weren't here. And so, but my father had not officially passed away, but he was in prison and hopped up, you know. And so, my grandparents were our foster parents, and because of that, you had to have social workers come. And every time the social worker comes, you know, it was like the warden had come. Like we didn't, it was like it didn't feel like this person was looking out for our welfare. It's more like if we fuck this shit up, then we're gonna have to like go to an orphanage or some shit. You know, so it was very scary. We didn't think of the social worker as our friend, you know. But the social worker would come, and one social worker, they weren't all that nice, but this social worker was really sweet, always gave us books, and had given me a coloring book because it was age appropriate. But had given my sister two books, and one of them was the Secret Garden, and I totally fell in love with it, appropriated for myself. You know, and like just really fell in love with the language of it all, and like, you know, like I love looking up new words. And so anyway, I kind of thought that would be my trajectory, and it's because also like it was a way to escape my life, you know, and like, you know, just being able to be transported. I mean, now when I look at literature from that era, it's very problematic, and I would probably be like trafficked. You know, I would not have the agency of these white characters, you know, even if it's David Copperfield, like even if it was like you had some trials and tribulations, it wouldn't be the same as like a coolie, you know. So, you know, like I wouldn't like stuck in an opium den, you know, whatever. Yeah. So yeah, but at the time I didn't have that, you know. So again, like that, you know, that changed, and that kind of affected. That's like a when I, you know, went to college, and I realized, and I took my first post-colonial literature class. I go, oh, I was identifying with the wrong ass people, because I would never, this would never be my situation in that era, you know. And so, you know, that it, then I realized, you know, like had a different understanding of being Vietnamese, you know. And at, you know, the same time as my, you know, my like race awareness was also when I came out. So, you know, like it's very much tied with like my queerness too. So yeah, and that changes, you know. So every kind of moment when you kind of have a new understanding of yourself, your understanding of what being Vietnamese is, and then it also becomes irrelevant too. Because for me, like, you know, like, you know, what does it mean to be Vietnamese? Like your original question, I find that, you know, like, sometimes it just locks people in. And I think, you know, I don't find a lot of power in locking myself into any identity that's static, you know? And so I think, like, you know, I'm hopefully, you know, I always have revelations about myself, you know?
Yeah, and that's a good point you bring up, because when I first started out, it was just, what does it mean to be Vietnamese? And then as it went along, I really began to realize that this changes a lot. So I added, what does it mean to be Vietnamese to you today? So that's like, you know, what, how do we market, how do we mark ourselves today? Like, how are we defining it today in the time? So when future generations hear this, they're like, okay, that's what it kind of meant for that person in that city at that time. And now it's like, oh, well, you know what? I want to hear how it's changed and how it's evolved for you. And I think that's now more, we get a bigger, a broader picture of this all, because Vietnamese identity changes and then our personal identity changes so much as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, completely.
Yeah. And so when you got to college, you studied English, or was it something related to that?
I was a completely colonized being, because I studied English literature with a double major in French.
Hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah, you know, so yeah, I dropped the double French double major. I was like, you know, one class away from being able to qualify for the double major. But it made me so angry, because I'd taken this post-colonial literature class and I'm like, fuck this shit, you know, like, what the fuck, like, you know. And then it made me, that's when I realized, you know, like, I had spent all this time, like 7 years, you know, intensely studying French. I mean, like, I didn't just study French, I was like really fucking into it. Like, when I was in high school, I felt that, you know, I joined the French class, the French club, and then I felt like the French classes, our advanced French classes, our honors French classes weren't rigorous enough. So I lobbied. We fucking fundraised. We put on a Valentine's Day dance. Bunch of fucking nerds put on this dance. This so we can fundraise for fucking more rigorous, advanced French books.
Like, you hardcore.
You know, so fucking dumb. But, you know, but like all these like cheerleaders and all these popular kids that we were not part of, you know, went to this dance that we curated because we wanted to have, you know, we didn't say it was like a, it was just that the French club had sponsored it, but like, we didn't say why it was, you know, we just said, here, just come and dance your ass off, you know. But yeah, and so that's kind of how hardcore I was with my French, and, you know.
So what does it mean to be French to you today?
Okay.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah. But, you know, when I went to college and, like, you know, I was just like, you know, I watched a French movie a week. I like I wanted to go to study abroad at some point, or like after college, I want to go to France. And so I wanted to, like, they said, like, that you really become, you know, a very fluent in French if you can and dream in French. So that was kind of like, if I could have a dream.
That was your goal.
Yeah. And I had a little bit of that, you know, but then at that moment I had, you know, just kind of understood what a, you know, colonized being was. And then I was like, fuck that shit. Like, so I know more. I knew the French pluperfect tense and all this book fucking, you know, like French is the tenses are insane. You know, most Germanic romantic language, the tenses are insane. But then I go, wow, I fucking can't even fucking read a newspaper in Vietnamese. The fuck,
oh,
you know,
shit.
You know, because Vietnamese newspapers, it's not how people talk, right? So it's like, it's kind of almost the opposite of like the English American newspapers, because they try to get you at a certain level. I think Vietnamese newspapers, like I could like still spell it out and like read it very slowly, but I didn't have a huge comprehension because a lot of the words was like, you know, chinti, what the fuck is that, you know? Mm-hmm. I didn't understand, and it made me so upset, like, here's this language that's built in that I have a whole community for, and I fucking just ignored it to the point where I don't, you know, like, I sound like a fucking idiot, you know. And, but here I can write a whole essay on like Victor Hugo, you know, and Baudelaire and like Fleur de Mal, you know, like stupid bullshit. And so anyway, so now I'm no longer fluent in French, but I'm not that great in Vietnamese either.
What do you think drove you to be such a Francophile?
Oh, because you know, like my grandparents, my aunts and uncles, that's what they thought was like, you know, high literature was like, you know, fucking classy shit, you know, like we just fucking bought into that bullshit. I mean, that's like, just because I didn't grow up during the French occupation doesn't mean like the residue and legacy of colonialism didn't, you know, isn't still affecting me. You know, I say it still is there, you know, like so many people like, oh, well, so-and-so, well, she knows, you know, she knew how to write in French. I'm like, so did every fucking person that had to like, fucking get educated, well, you know, whatever.
Well, you know, what it's going to become in like 10 years is like, you know, it's going to be the whole Korean thing, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's going to be the same thing. It's like, oh, yeah, he went to study in Korea, or you know, she was part of this K-pop, you know, management agency. It's going to be all of that too, and you know, at some point, we're going to have to cash in our chips, our Vietnamese chips, and be like, no, 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 guys, we need to be the fucking destination for all young people. And for, or am I wrong? Am I wrong to be thinking this way?
You know, I think Vietnam is already becoming that, but I don't think it's the same thing because it's not like fucking Korea is going to us and colonizing us and like calling us coolies and making us like conscripting us to work on rubber plantations. So it's not quite the same, but good yeah. Point. Yeah, you know, so the French are a whole different thing. They weren't like taxing 30% of our GDP with salt and shit, you know. So but what I think, you know, I totally think that actually, you know, the Saigon economy, you know, this, you know, I mean, COVID kind of puts everything out of whack, but I think people are already looking to Saigon, I mean, to like Vietnam in general as an economic power. You know, it might not be as recognized yet, you know, but if you're talking about like culturally about K-pop, I think like, you know, like Vietnamese artists are coming up, like, you know, Fury. I was like the Netflix movie. I mean, it's not a Netflix movie, but you know, it came on Netflix.
It was, I think it was on Netflix for a little bit there.
Yeah, yeah. So, but
they bought it. They licensed it.
Yes, yes. So, but I thought that was kind of really amazing, you know. And it was so funny. Like we just were like, this is like Taken, but with like, right, with like by Vietnamese. But I also we also like, well, she's really girl bossy. And then we saw like a picture of her eating somewhere, and she had a shirt that said "Girl Boss" on it, and it was just hilarious.
Oh, that's so funny.
Because it's like pretty much all season her girl bossing, right? You know, so I don't think Vietnam's very far away from that. And like Dustin Nguyen's movie years and years ago, it had already kind of augured in that. Like I feel like when he like plays a villain for the first time, I really loved it. So I think it's becoming like a cultural power already. It's, you know, and I kind of like that the way or how it's organically becoming, and you know, so I don't think we're far away from that.
Did you ever, because I remember going to your restaurant, Good Girl Dinette, a few times, and I went with my good friend Anderson Lay, and I don't remember if he mentioned anything about you being adjacent to the film business.
No, I'm just a supporter. You know, I love visual communications.
Okay.
You know, and like, you know, that was a major event for us, you know, in our 20s, you know, like we would like, this is, you know, before everything became digital, like they would have this like, you know, whole program. And, you know, we definitely like, you know, like that's how we planned it. Like, okay, are you going to the short films? Are you, you know, like we like, and I, all my friends were like either on a jury for some selection or in the short films or whatever, you know. And I love Leslie Ito, who, you know, and for Linda, you know, so like that was always been in our, you know, in my like consciousness.
So you're old school. Wow.
It was,
you've been around
fun,
this,
you know,
for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, we'd watch the premiere and stuff, but we really love the obscure short stuff. You know, because that's like, you know, it's just like, or like this one movie, like it was called, I forgot, but it was like this experimental film, feature length. And I just love the visual communication, like gave it an audience, you know, like these films that would never kind of like reach, like even an art house film. You know, even to reach an art film is very hard. So I love that. And, you know, and shorts is great because it's like, you know, short films are great because if you don't like it, it's done in 5 minutes. So it always gave a chance to, you know, so you got to watch 10 films, you know, and, you know, I've always been trying to tell Leslie, you know, but life got in the way, but I'm like, Leslie, it's time to do like an Asian American food film festival, because all these young, you know, at the time in the 90s, all these young filmmakers, one of the first things they always did was like did something food related, like someone like filmed like did an experimental film on kimchi making, or you know, so it was always like that also featured in so many narratives, you know. So I'm hoping one day that's going to happen, because I think it'd be super fun. And you know, my idea, you know, and I just could never make it happen because I was running the restaurant, but I was like, Leslie, like just think, like just like even if it's archival, like just look at the old submissions, you know. It's just like, let's do like, and you know, I mean, I feel like now the 90s is like all that fashion is actually hip again, so it might be really cool, but like you know, so I grew up
the retrospective,
exactly, and just like pick the food related ones, you know, it could be transcendentally too, and there's a, you know, like I used to love the Garfield Theater in San Gabriel Valley, and there was like an Asian art, you know, like they showed like really like Hong Kong Jackie Chan movies and stuff, like some crazy movies where people just getting disemboweled. It was kind of like a little snuffy to me, you know, so I'm like, I'll avoid that shit. But but their concession stand was great because they had popcorn, but they also had bakul and mukul, and you know, and I was like, wouldn't it be fucking great to have like an event where like, you know, in Korea, like they would actually grill cuttlefish for you inside a theater, like fire inside a theater, fire inside a theater. Like,
just hardcore.
We wouldn't do that, but I mean, it'd be so fun. You know, to have like an outdoor screening and just have like, just like, you know, Vietnamese concessions or like Korean concession, you know, because I would die of happiness to smell, you know, muk. McCall next to me. My girlfriend on the other hand would not be too pleased, but like, you know, with some hoisin and sriracha, man, you know, heaven, you know.
You know, let's just for everybody listening, visual communication, if you're listening, Dip said it twice, it's not a phrase that's like, oh, just visually communicating. It's an actual nonprofit entity here in Los Angeles. It's been a good 7 decades, I think, in existence, and they host the I believe it's the LA Asian Film Festival.
They gave Justin Lin his start.
Yeah,
you know, John Cho, Shopping for Fangs, that was his first feature that he appeared in. So like, it, yeah, they were the launching pad, and still are the launching pad for a lot of talent.
And it's very empowering because you know, just recently I was sitting talking to 2 young Taiwanese kids, one from Taiwan, one Taiwanese American, and they were complaining to me that they were applying to internships in Hollywood and not getting a call back. I'm like, have you heard of the LA Asian Film Festival? They're like, no. I'm like, well, go volunteer for that, and you can meet people in the industry and yada, yada, yada. And it's a wonderful place to really congregate and build your social tribe, because that is where a lot of us have networked and met, you know, all the people that we know.
And that's how I know of Anderson Leh through the organization too.
Yeah, exactly. And it's that, and for some reason, film and food are so intertwined in this city and throughout the world. I've noticed that a lot of people that worked in the film industry go into the food industry and vice versa. And Anderson Leh is no exception. His family are of the Pig and the Lady in Hawaii, and Piggy Smalls for, you know, everybody.
Which is a great name.
Yeah, it's amazing. So when you got to college and you're studying literature and French, and were you cooking? Were you involved in food?
I was cooking for my friends, obviously, because I wanted a career in academics. It was my first time having my own kitchen, because, you know, my grandma was such like a force that you just, you know, her kitchen was her domain, you know, and it just like, she's like a bright star, just burn the fuck out of you, you know? So like, I got to be my own little I got to go into a different galaxy in which grandma was did not loom large, and so I got to learn how to cook for the first time. I mean, my grandma taught me how to cook because she wanted to make sure that when I lamzo, I know how to cook all bullshit,
Okay, so you have a grandmother who's old school, back, right? Northern old school. Okay, and so this concept of lamzo, right? Let's talk about that because I can't
Bullshit.
imagine. It is utterly bullshit, but it is worthy to talk about because this is a paradigm that is patriarchal. It is it's upside down. It is all the things. It's misogynist. I mean, it's just pure bullshit. But lamzo means,
And it's upheld by women, and it's
yes,
executed by women.
by women. You're
The
absolutely right.
men benefit from it, but the women are the enforcers.
Yeah, and it is crazy because if you are lamzo means you are a
Work, like you
you're a
working.
workhorse. Yeah,
I'm.
you're the family slave, but okay, so you are the daughter-in-law basically to the family. So you move into the man side, the husband side, and you lamzo, you are their servant basically. You're an indentured servant
For a
to
yak like a year, for like a year.
yeah.
There is a time limit on this bullshit.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's
I
only for a
didn't.
year. I mean, it's kind
Oh,
of like the
really?
when you get married and you have your own first job, you give a year of your the son has to give a year of the salary to the mom. Is
I
that
didn't
that's
know that.
that's I mean, it's not enforced as strictly, but if you're
Yeah.
gonna you're a good mama's boy, you do that's what you do is
Okay, so when you were growing up and you hear these sort of like these ideas, at what point in your mental sort of capacity are you reacting?
I'm like never. Well, okay, so I never questioned that I would get married or have to get married, and this is why I was so drawn to English literature, it's like and especially a particular kind of literature, which is like Victorian literature, which focus heavily on female romantic friendships, like friendships that are romantic, but like from the neck up. And so the idea of I just imagine this is that I would get married to a very gentle man, And we'd have a wonderful relationship, and I like I said from the neck up, and then at night we would just turn off the lights, and he would do what he had to do, and we forget about it. And the next day I would like resume my life with my all these fr female friends that I have that I love romantically. Like it was like. That's really I thought that was the height of it. It's just like, look, I'm not trying to go for a macho guy. I'm not trying to I want the most feckless man, who's gonna just go what I need to go. And like the most asexual man is like, yes, you are the one for me, and so that's kind of what I thought, if I the route I had to go, before it came out, and I go, I don't fucking have to marry a man. So, so I was much more worried about the future mother-in-law, because even my grandma, as much as she enforced it, she also hated it. Because she married, she agreed for my mom to marry my father because my father's mother who was already deceased, and she says, "Oh, we agreed to this marriage because she doesn't have to lamzo because the mom was already dead." So so even the women who go through
Oh,
it kind of like fuck that shit too, but obviously not fuck that shit, So it's I feel like I was kind of laughing I think I feel like daughter-in-laws and mother-in-laws spend a whole lifetime trying to repair the fucking bullshit that happened in the first year of her joining the
wow.
family, because it's brutal, and it's the concept behind it is that, you're not bringing anything to the fucking family. You're like a fucking drain. That's why, they didn't invest in girls because, why would we invest in a daughter? Because she's gonna go to another family anyway. you know? And then when you, so like you didn't have any value in your birth family, and you go to your husband's family, and you don't have no fucking value either. So then you have to, even though you fucking bring a dowry with you know, and then you have to like, or like become like an unpaid internship, you know, until you become a mother and you can do that bullshit to some other woman. It's
Yeah,
just like really
and
bullshit.
that trauma goes deep because I've seen it in my own family where the sisters of the brothers like gang up on the
Yeah.
zealot, and it's not 1 year, it's like the whole life of the woman, and then it creates all this weird dynamic because it's like if the zealot comes from like a more affluent or more established family, the politics inside the women who are the siblings of the man, it gets all dicked up. It gets all weird and discombobulating where there's like jealousy because that family didn't bring us to America, all this crazy shit. And for life, this poor daughter-in-law is crucified because she's not from this original family. And it just I don't know how and why these things are continuing in the world today.
Yeah, it's bullshit. But you know, like not, you know, like I don't want to make it like women had no agency in this. Like some women get out of it. Like one, like look, we gotta fucking move away from your fucking family. Though I don't have to deal with them except for the holidays or something. You know, like
Yeah.
you find workarounds and that, and you know, and but the thing is that, you know, I'm trying to think like, you know, I mean, obviously my grandma must have had a mo had her Lamzo year, but I can't imagine because she was so powerful, you know, and she had grandpa like. Grandpa was like anything you want, you know. So I feel like grandma's like she never felt, you know, she was like this is bullshit, but she never felt powerless. She's like, I'm gonna get through this fucking year, and we're gonna go out and we're gonna strike out on our own, you know. And I'm gonna become my own millionaire, you know.
Yeah.
So you know, like it's not like women don't get out of it, you know. But you can't get caught in where, you know, you think like the approbation of your husband's family is all there is, and like not all
Yeah.
women kind of fall into that trap, you know.
So you're cooking, in college, and after college, do you go out and you get a regular job, or are you now finding yourselves in more of the kitchen space?
No, you know, so when I realized I don't want to, I want to decolonize myself. And like, so I stopped taking French. I took more, you know, ethnic studies, sociology. And then, you know, I was like, and this is during the time of the LA uprising. So 92, I
Yep.
graduated in 94. So then I was
You go
just
to school
like,
out here in LA or
I went
back
to
east or?
UC Riverside. And we had this wonderful professor. Her name was Edna Bonasich. She and Ed Lee, co-sponsored this. Edmund Lee co-sponsored, or like wrote a paper, or like came up with this idea of like you know, what is it called? The Asian middleman, which is kind of like, you know, how it, you know, the modern minority myth has actually backfired on the Asian American community. It has become like a place for like white America to like absolve itself of its sins by saying that, you know, by putting up this modern minority as a as like an idea that you can succeed in this, and there's no racism, but at the same time they become a buffer, you know. So all like all the anger that rises up from racial inequity gets, you know, focused on you know, ethnic you know, or immigrant businessmen or business people. So anyway, so that kind of really, you know, like they can, you know, they talked about this as a theory, and you know, or like not theory, but you know, like this construct. But then here it was playing out
In real
in the
life.
LA uprising. And so like, you know, I just like, you know, I really, it changed my trajectory, because I'm like, you know, I don't want to be a professor, like sit in a fucking ivory tower, and as much as I love literature, it didn't feel like it was like purposeful, you know. And so I wanted to like really do social justice work. And you know, I still wasn't in my head. I'm like, oh, I'd love to own a restaurant one day, cook the food I wanted to cook, that's like not like exactly like the food my relatives and grandparents cook. But I just didn't really feel called. I felt it kind of frivolous. And so I said, I wanted for, you know, I said, so I talked to Edna, and I talked to some other folks, and they're like, that'd be great, you know. And And I said, I don't want to be in academia. And at the time, we were already doing like protests. We were also like, you know, every weekend we were going to Beverly Hills to protest sweatshop work. Because this is like during the time of the El Monte sweatshop work. I mean, that was pure, that was truly traffic slave work, because they were like behind, you know, barbed wire. People don't know about it. You can Google it, the El Monte sweatshop scandal, you know. And so somebody said to me, like, you know, nonprofit work, it's really hard work, and you'll probably burn out in 10 years. That's kind of like what people say. And I said, especially the work I wanted to do. And so I said, I could give my first 10 years out of college doing this, you know. Wow. I'll burn the fuck out. And, you know, and like they said, the pay isn't great. And I'm like, I don't fucking care. Like, I don't fucking live an extravagant life. And, you know, like, I just felt like the older I got, the more I would care about a mortgage, you know, or care about a savings or retirement, you know. Like, I was like, why not? Like, these years, I don't have to compromise. I can live really spare, you know. And that's what I did. So I, like, my first job, I made $17,000 a year, you know. But it was like all the work I wanted to do. But in the back of my head, like, I said, in 10 years, like when I graduated, in 10 years, I want to own a restaurant. And then in 10 years, I owned a restaurant. Like, you know, like 3 years before the 10 years was going to be up, I said, I should like actually start looking at, you know, wow, how to, so I like wrote a business plan, took some classes, that kind of thing. And, you know, but, you know, I'm really glad I did that, because in the 10 years I was working in nonprofit, I really got to understand labor, the issues of labor, the issues affecting workers. And, you know, and like, you know, this is a time when, like, I felt like my understanding of a living wage increased. And, you know, it was kind of like 10 years of a meditation, and like, what would it mean to have a restaurant, you know? And so I enacted all of those values in my restaurant. I think if I had just opened a restaurant and not have had that experience of like 10 years of meditation, and yeah, what does it truly mean to have a restaurant that doesn't exploit labor? Because when you start to do that, like when I first started to price out my dishes, I was just doing one of the ways in which you price out your dishes, you kind of just set the price to what the current market is setting.
The comps, yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm like, okay, you know, I think at the time maybe like Dofa was like, I'm trying to remember,
$7, $8.
Yeah, like sometimes it was like six, you know, like maybe mm-hmm. 6 to 8, you know, like there was. And so I said, okay, if that's the case, then here's my food cost, here's my this cost, here's my rent, and here, you know, like prorate the rent to once a year, whatever. And it turned out, I'm like, oh my god, this doesn't work. And so yeah, and that's when you realize, oh, the labor, people are shortchanging the labor, you know. And so you know, I just said, okay, I'm not going to do it that way. I'm going to actually, like, I start with my labor, and I wanted to start everybody off at $1 above minimum wage, like the lowest paid worker, which usually is the dishwasher, is paid $1 above minimum wage. And then I worked up that way. And that's where I got to my cost, which was like higher than anyone else's, mm-hmm. you know, and they were like, the fuck? I'm like, that's what it is, you know, like, and the bowls were smaller, you know, like, I took a lot of hit, okay? I took the hit for the culture, okay? Every time somebody fucking complained to me, I said, I do this, I you know, I'm doing this for the greater good. Like, so when you go to eat fall somewhere else, you know, you think, oh, that's cheap versus this is expensive. This should be the norm, and that's cheap. And then you should ask why it's cheap, you know? And for me, like, I have like a great, you know, I have like almost profound empathy for the market forces that small business, especially immigrant businesses, have to contend with in terms of pricing. So I never wanted to shame anybody, but it was more like, hey, if you're someone who's thinking about owning a restaurant, because I think a restaurant that's already in existence, their business model is their business model. It's hard to come out of that. But yeah, if you're starting a business, here, why don't you start off? Don't think about, you know, what's comparable prices. Start with how much you want to pay, and then go above from that, you know. And so, yeah. So anyway, that's kind of how I started the restaurant.
Well, I think the state of affairs for restaurants and food in California is kind of fucked. It's bleak.
It is,
It's
yeah.
bleak. Unless you're charging like top dollar, and even top dollar, like a restaurant like True Food, right? I just don't see the economics working out long term, and especially like you see that in the grocery store, things are like almost double. You see gas prices up. But you don't see restaurants raising their prices double, or you don't even see it 15, 20%. They raised it, but you don't really see it. So how is it all like the math working out? Because it's not really compensating and catching up yet.
I think it will, and I do think it's because people are so afraid. I think what's
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Happening is, restaurant owners and like independent operators, they're just taking a hit. They're working longer hours.
Yeah.
They're working those, if they're working 11 hours before, they work at 14 now. You know what I mean? Like,
Yeah.
it's really, so I don't think it's necessarily sustainable. And, I think people really like, oh, I miss sitting down and having service. And I go, okay, but how much, how fucking important is that? Like, fucking get it fast casual. Like, I think it's just, in some ways, I think the business model of like old school, places are going to be more like, what do you want? Number one? Okay, you're done. Yeah. None of the nice idea. Like, over there, like, what's the fucking matter with that? Like, you want to go like full service, you know, it's either if it's if the price is low, that means like workers aren't getting paid, or like operators are working more hours unpaid and just trying to take a hit. But I really am very, I really want to see actually Vietnamese restaurant go to more, even more to a fast casual, and I'd love for folks to find a way to kind of like imbue it with hospitality, but without service, because you can, no one complains about like Shake Shack's lack of service,
Yeah.
but they're fast casual. But they have a sense of hospitality or whatever, and so this is kind of, I'm like, that's kind of what I want to see. Like, Vietnamese restaurateurs are very resourceful, and it's like, this is the way to go. Like, you just got to figure out a way to like still imbue it with hospitality without like a lot of, so it, the less workers you have, the less labor you have, the more you can pay your labor to, like, so it's just, and the thing is that, people are leaving the restaurant workers are leaving the industry because the pay is so terrible. I'm like, actually, so you're even having a hard time finding staff willing
Oh my
to
God, it's
work.
hard.
Yeah. And I don't buy that. It's like a labor shortage. It's more like people don't want to fucking work in that fucking environment, And so like, how do you like, I think a fast casual could be an opportunity to like, how do you like create, a working environment that actually people want to come back to, and it's not because people are lazy. It's because they're like, "Fuck this shit," And I'm like, for me, like if it's either operators or workers, I always kind of side with the workers because they always get shafted. Because really, when a restaurant goes under, it's the majority of the times it's the workers haven't paid to 2 weeks already. They're always holding the bag, And so I'm very interested in, I'm very empathetic
Empathetic,
to
yeah.
how hard it is for operators, because I used to be one too, but at the same time, like, as hard as we have it, we just can't use that to then like, ignore the people who actually do the work every
Yeah.
day, and
How
without
long?
any benefit of profit sharing, unless it's
Yeah.
a worker-owned project,
How long did you have Good Girl Dinette?
I had Good Girl Dinette for like 9.5 years. Yeah, I was really trying to hold on to the to I get to 10, and I'm like, why the fuck am I doing this? And that's
Yeah.
a and it, and you know and one of the reasons why, well, a main part of why I sold the site to Burger Lords, love them, was that, rent was getting high.
Yeah.
You know, like they were increasing my rent and I was like, I can't absorb that, you know? And I was just doing the numbers and it was getting really dire. And I realized if I go on and I agree to this newer rent, I would not be able to pay my payroll and I will shut down. And that was the thing. I was like, I cannot not make that, you know, not honor the obligation every 2 weeks, you know? And so that made the hard choice, like, instead of like trying to wait it out and not pay people, I should just quit when I know I can for sure pay my payroll. And so, and you know, and people used to say, oh, it's because she paid too much. I'm like, no, it had nothing to do with my, you know, I did pay more than the average, you know, but it was like, it was the rent that was the final deciding factor in my wanting to close, you know, and not to mention, you know, like my knees were like not so good. My fucking body was falling apart and stuff, but you know, like I just, you know, like I bump into you know, former employees all the time, and not all the time, but like you know, enough times, you know, and it's like I never have to like avert my eyes. I never, you know, like look at their face, how are you doing, you know, like, you know, so I feel like that was more valuable to me than, you know,
yeah,
keeping it going.
Anybody who can last more than 3 years as an operator has grit.
Yeah, it's, I mean, yeah.
Anything over a year is brutal.
Yeah, the first year is just like you really it tests your mettle, like what you mm-hmm. made of, girl, you know, and you know, because it's like, you know, like it's the first year is like if you're gonna shit any bricks, you be shitting bricks then, you know what I mean? Like it's like it's fucking real, you know, like I mean the first weekend of your opening, you're like, oh, this fucking dream, why the fuck did I dream this dream, you know?
That's
like
so true.
Yeah.
Any reason anybody has before they go into a restaurant is all bullshit. It's all, you know, it's all like weird idealistic things that once you hit the practical rubber meets the road, things are completely different than what you thought they were.
Yeah. And I come from a family of restaurants.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like they're like, when they heard I was over to your restaurant, they're like, we finally understand what you do, because they had no understanding what I did in social work, but they also said, don't do it. You know what I mean? So, but even, yeah, it's like, it's also very different because, you know, if it's like a restaurant that's some sort of like is like some reflection of your, like a love of yours, you know, every dish that didn't execute 100% feels very personal. Every person who wasn't 100% satisfied feels like a failure, you know? So it's like, it's very different, like working in a restaurant and executing dishes versus like, it's your name, it's your vision. And it's just, and that's it's not like the physical work, it's the psychological trauma that like gets you, you know? And like, did you know that most restaurant workers, like I was going through like ADP and they were talking up their payroll services, and they said, we can, you know, we can alleviate you of all these you know, these headaches of payroll. And I, you know, and they're like, because you know, when is what like the most common time employers send in their payroll information? And I'm like, I don't. And it's just 2 a.m I'm like, that is fucking true, because every 2 a.m I was like putting, you know, so I was like, oh fuck. And I ended up going with ADP because I couldn't afford the extra. I just fucking did everything by hand. That's probably why I'm burned out too. But you know, but it's like, yeah, so like you're like you're kind of sleeping and you're like, oh fuck, it's like tomorrow's payroll, you know, I need to send payroll in tonight so that 2 days later, you know, I can have paychecks. You know, it's just like crazy stuff like that. So
shit is real.
Yeah.
So when you were close to deciding to shut down, what did you think that you were going to transition into?
You know, I don't know. You know, I've been always wanting, you know, like to write more. And I just, you know, owning a restaurant and like having a writing practice is like,
they don't go hand
hard
in hand.
They don't, you know, I was able to write a few things here and there, but it wasn't like anything regular. And so I thought, you know what, you know, I'll get back to writing. I just kind of like really didn't care. Like I'll get an admin job, you know, like I just wanted, like, really, I was just, once I decided that we were going to close, I just wanted to make sure that, you know, we had like a month and a half to find new employment for the staff that were there. We just, you know,
Wow.
want I wanted to say goodbye to the neighborhood like that. We just wanted to execute, you know. And that was, and it I mean, because really, this had been such a dream. It was like, it was, you know, gut-wrenching and stuff, you know. But, you know, so like thinking about what was next, like it kind of didn't register and didn't matter, you know.
And so what did you end up, how did you transition out?
Well, so, you know, I think like it was maybe a month or so, or maybe even before it closed, Gulong Pham of Red Book Fish Sauce emailed me and says, "Hey, I hear that you're closing. Do you want to go to Vietnam, go to Phu Quoc with me, you
Wow.
know?" And because he'd been asking for a while, and I said, "I'm so busy, you know, and I can't pay, I don't have enough money to pay staff to do the work I need to do. To go." And he goes, "Well, you don't have that problem anymore." So, so,
Then,
and
yeah.
that's, yeah. And then, yeah. And then we did that. So that was like, you know, super fun. And then when
What
I
year was
was,
that?
2018,
Oh, I didn't realize you
maybe
closed.
19, early. Yeah. We closed like in October 2018. So,
Wow, okay.
yeah. So I don't remember. It was like the first of the year 2019 or something. But no, I think it must have been earlier, because what happened was that, so we I went to Vietnam, and he had like he had a documentary, a documentarian film there. And so I was kind of like a, you know, like a chef's perspective on stuff. And then that was when I got to know Gung better, more the operation better. And I'd like, oh, I really like how he runs his business and how he treats his workers and stuff. So that's when I was like, hey, I should, if you want, let's like, I'd love to be your R&D chef. And then I came back, and then Dave Chang called me up and said, "I'd love for you to go to Beirut to interview a shawarma master with Chris Ying." And I'm like, okay.
That is so random. But did you know Dave Chang from the restaurant? Did he
I
come in? How
did.
did
I
you? Yeah,
did.
okay.
I know him because he, I he, his team interviewed me for Ugly Delicious, season one. And then he asked me on to his podcast. And then we just had a good time. And then he said, like, "Hey, you want to go to Beirut for me with Chris?" And so I know nothing about Beirut, but I would love to go. And so it ended up like I was interviewing a refugee Syrian shawarma master who was now in Beirut. And so he introduced Syrian style shawarma to Lebanon, like, you know. And I got to understand, like, you know, the difference between Syrian shawarma versus Lebanese shawarma, you know. And you know, and like I just knew, like, I'm like, oh, I'm interviewing a refugee. Like, I kind of channeled all the things I hate, all the questions I hate when people ask about refugees, is what they just want to talk about their refugee experience, but they never talk about you. Like, the thing is, the interesting thing about Abu wasn't necessarily because he was a refugee, but he was a shawarma master from Damascus who had a following. So once he opened in Beirut, like, people were already clamming, you know. And like, he had this like really wonderful, so I just wanted to ask him more about his expertise than just like, you know, because I think people think that our refugee experience defines us, you know, completely. You know, it doesn't. I know this. And so, you know, and Abu, and like when I first met him, you know, he was kind of a little standoffish, you know. And then when I asked, like, not, I think he was expecting me to answer those questions that are kind of very basic questions, you know. And then he realized, oh, you're asking like real questions, like about me versus like idea you think of, you know. And so he like got really into it, you know. And like, it's like he talked about how he learned how to like make shawarma by like sneaking, but really like sneaking looks when the master went looking, because they're all very secretive. And like, he like looked through a peephole and like, you know, a knot in the wall, you know. So it's kind of, it was very Tempopo, you know. So like, and it was really, got into it, and I was just like, it was really great, you know. So and I got to like try, like, I had never had like raw lamb's, what is that, liver before, and the texture was amazing, you know. So like I it was like yeah. So and then after that, I told Dave I could only stay there for like 2 days, could I go back, kind of fly back so I could do my Benton Collective, you know. So it was just like a whirlwind, and I was just like, well, you know, this is not so bad, you know, go just having like just more experiences I had for a long time, because I was just like really just wanting to make this restaurant work.
Yeah, God, we gotta go. I want to like check out this shawarma master. I have to tangentially like make a turn because I couldn't. My brain couldn't get out of the question. What the fuck is a shawarma master? Like, what does it take to become a shawarma master?
I mean, it's like
I didn't
it
even know that
takes
that
years.
existed.
Yeah, I mean, it's like quite an art, you know. And his spit, we did. He said, "We'll do a small spit today." It was 30 kilos. 30 kilos was the smallest, and it's like you have to be a master at like meat cutting, understand like how to like. Because I think like you know like he gets his lamb real young. He has it's like all these like considerations you have to make sure that the lamb is the what it is, and the seasoning is like so simple, so you have to understand just the quality, you know. And so he like I was talking to him, and then he like let me cut some lamb with him, which I'm like okay, you know, like I just thought, you know. So it was like real yeah, re really eye-opening, and it made me really appreciate just the hard work that goes into. It's kind of like pho, you know, like if people don't know about it, they don't really have a lot of respect for it because they don't
Yeah.
know, you know, never your kung fu to get there, right? You know, and like you could tell his kung fu was like great, you know, because it's just like the way he cut, the way he's able to like shape it, and like just and it's a layering of fat and lean too, you know. So it's not just putting stuff on and then you're done, you know.
Yeah, there's so much to that shawarma or what's the Mexican one?
A pastor,
Pastor.
yeah.
Yeah, there's so much magic to that that it is. Now that you say you associate the word master to shawarma or al pastor, it is insane. There's a restaurant in LA called Abash. I don't know if you've heard of it. It comes from the owner comes from this other small hole in the wall called Roro's, and their shawarma is to me the best in the city, and it's just a hole in the wall. And now that you bring up this whole idea of a shawarma man, I'm gonna go talk to Maurice over at Al Bash,
Yeah,
because
yeah.
yeah, his is the best. His shawarma is the best in the city, and it's chicken
What style
shawarma,
is it? What style is it?
Lebanese.
Okay. Yeah, because
Lebanese.
what Abu told me is that the Lebanese prefer leaner shawarma, whereas Syrian shawarma is a little fattier, and I prefer the little fattier because I love
Yes.
fago. So yeah, so for me, fago is the best. You know, that's the best cut for pho. You know, so yeah, it was amazing. Like the top, you know, like a Mexican pastor is like the top is a pineapple. The top of abu is like just like a layer of lamb's fat. It just like trickles down,
And it
so it's
just
just
drip.
like
And the chicken shawarma I think has yogurt in it, the Lebanese one. I don't know if that tenderizes the chicken, but God almighty, the flavor on that place. Yeah, best
Well,
in the.
I gotta check it out.
Yeah, we should probably go sometime. It's
Yeah.
just amazing, absolutely amazing. So then once you started to you came back from Fukuoka, came back from Beirut, things started to settle down. Then, what started to move? I mean, COVID came in, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have, yeah, I mean, but I think it was 2019 I became the R&D chef for Red Boat, so it was like a year of not COVID, not yet COVID. And
Yeah.
so but that year, you know, we were working on a proposal for a cookbook with Thiên Nguyễn. Thiên Nguyễn's my partner, but she also like when I was talking to her about like, oh, you know, let's think about some, you know, I'm like bouncing ideas off of her, like, you know, the fun projects we can do. I knew I wanted to do like a chef's rub series, you know, like right, chefs that, you know, have like a great relationship with Red Boat, and it's like a charitable giving a collaboration. And so we did one with Brian Ng of Casilla, And his all this all the you know 10% of the proceeds went to like an animal rescue that he mm-hmm. really loves. And then we did one with Stuart Brioza, who's like a big supporter of Red Boat, and he did a spice garam salt, and his went to zero footprint, which is a program to offset carbon credits for yeah. restaurants, just anyway to increase the amount of farms that transition to more sustainable practices. And then we did like a caramel, and then so we were all I had all these ideas, and I wanted like, and I said like, we should also do a nukjum, an instant nukjum. And then things like, oh, when's Red Boat's anniversary, or when did Red Boat start? And then it going said, oh, 2011. And so we're like, oh, things like was telling me that, oh, 10 years is up, almost up, it's like 2 years away, you should write a cookbook. And so I asked Inigum in a call, and we just proposed it to Gun, and then Thien started on the proposal to send out to a publishing company. And so yeah, so we pitched the idea, got it greenlit, or got it HMH mm-hmm. yeah, HMH acquired it, the publishing house. And then we spent the pandemic writing it. Yeah. Perfect, the first of the right? pandemic. Yeah. Yeah. It was
perfect
crazy
timing.
Though. Yeah. I mean, we was just like, we don't want to go to the supermarket shopping. We don't want to fucking die. So like every time we went to supermarket shopping, we just couldn't make a mistake because we didn't want to go out again, okay, let's just do, and then we kind of bought like twice as much as we needed because I knew I was going to mess up one time, just stuff like that.
Random shit. Yeah. So random. You've mentioned to me before that you love LA so much.
I do.
But why do you love LA?
What do makes I love it? What, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not completely logical, but at the same time, totally logical, like love is, one is I love LA because, for the precise reason people don't love it, because they say there's no city core, I love that there's just like pockets of a neighborhood that make up a whole, so there's no centralized place. And because of that, you just have these very distinctive neighborhoods. And it's like home to like the largest Thai community, home to the largest community outside of Korea, Vietnam, and all that stuff. And they're the largest populations outside of Korea, but at the same time, they're all centered around LA. So what we have is critical mass in Los Angeles that you don't have anywhere else. And and I'm gonna like make an enemy by saying like, whatever the East Coasters are thinking, like their Asian community is strong, they have nothing compared to West Coast, particularly SoCal, like our critical mass is so amazing. And so we get to have these conversations that don't get interrupted because, other places, they're not the majority, And so the conversation is richer, and it's not so much of I was the only kid, I was the only Asian kid, it's like, no, it's like you had a whole community. And that's why Little Saigon in Orange County is so amazing, is because that community wasn't created to talk to white people. Yeah, that community was created for Nguyen Viet, and because of that, the food, the conversations, the culture has depth to it. So much depth to it that Nguyen Viet from Vietnam today, and these who in Little Saigon to see what's up,
Yeah.
and so that's like, for me, that's why I think Los Angeles is because of the critical mass and because of the political work that is being done here, like the El Monte case, really, there was a lot of leadership that was formed to combat such a work, and it originated in Los Angeles. It was also AWA, which is a San Francisco based, but so much comes from here. So much talent comes from the, I'm not sure what it was called now, but it used to be called Asian Pacific Legal Center, like all the lawyers doing, like Kim Lu Ying, you know, she an asylum lawyer, like it, all, so much talent comes because you had this moment, you know, like, you know, the ethnic studies or Asian, yeah, you know, we UCLA had the first Asian American studies department, you know, like, can't touch it, you know what I mean, whatever, East Coast. It's like, and you know, I'm not, you know, for me, like, I always know, like, where, like, when, like, East Coast Asian Americans, you're from the East Coast, I could tell just the way you're just like, you know, like, just, you know, it's not your fault you were born, you didn't grow up here, it's not your fault, you know. What are we talking about, how Asian America is like so fucking great in New York, okay?
But there is a big difference between the East Coast and West Coast, anything, you know, East and West Coast Asians are, you know, it's different. And I think that the East Coast Asians that come out to the West Coast to live, it gives a richness to the West Coast, because these East Coast Asians bring a certain their culture, and it reinforces this, strengthen a different part of our West Coast culture. It gives a, you know, I gotta give it to them. They grind, they'll go harder. You gotta give it to them, right? The East
Go
Coast.
harder? They go harder?
You don't
I
think
don't think
so?
so. I don't think so. LA, baby. You know? Yeah. Not just like SoCal, not just LA. SoCal is like untouched, you know? So yeah. So when I say LA, you know, like I mean like this whole environs of like some parts of Orange County too. So
Think I want to hear who you think are some of the leaders in the Vietnamese American space today, if you're comfortable talking about that.
Okay. Well, yeah, no doubt it does work. But you know, I you know, and you know, Ocean Vuong's book just came out, you know, so
Those Besides those two, are there any other prominent voices in the Vietnamese American space that is mainstream and white people are listening? Are they making effective changes with their moves?
well, you know, I mean, that's kind of interesting that, you know, like one, this like this favoring of like prominent, you know, because I do think like, I mean, why I love LA is because it's not just one person, it's like a whole community. So I think like, you know, like so for me, like if that's always like that's the organizer in me, you know, not one person, but like a whole community. Like I think visual communications, you know, like a great is a great you know organization that helped, you know, like yeah, Justin Lin. I mean, you know, come on, who doesn't love Fast and the Furious? I mean, who didn't remember kind of like the cultural shift that came after Tokyo Drift? You know,
Absolutely.
you know what I mean? So I think like not just you know Justin Lin, John Cho, you know, but there's also like you know John Cho's first feature I think was with Quentin from Quentin Lee. I think it's Quentin.
Quickly,
Yeah, Quentin Lee. I was like Quentin Tarantino. Quentin
quickly.
Lee in Shopping for Fangs, you know, or that was the first time I heard of him, and that was kind of I think his breakout role, you know. So you know, yeah. So there's you know Margaret Cho. I mean, they all like connected in this way, you know. But I'm not sure, like you know, do I really care about prominence? I do really kind of care what
Okay, yeah,
white
that's
people
a
are
great.
listening to, you know what I
But
mean?
see, that's a
But what's
great answer.
inspiring to me is different. Yeah.
That's a great answer, but at the same time, and we were debating about this very thing last night. Who gives a fuck about prominence? Well, all right, well, let's debate that, because somebody needs to speak out and say shit and move things. And if you don't have the quote unquote the prominence or the pedestal to like shoot out these messages or tweet out these ideas, then do we have a voice? I mean, that's debatable, right? And that's what we were talking about last night. A lot of us were just like, it got heated. It's like we this very idea of prominence and why mainstream matters. We're debating it. Does it matter? It kind of does. I mean, everybody was arguing in different directions, but it kind of does if you think about it, because without a Viet Thanh win, the United States sometimes wouldn't listen or wouldn't have an opportunity to debate this thought from our position. And so somebody like Vietnam Nguyen.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think you're falling into like, if you're like, oh, without Viet, no one would talk. It's more like, because Viet's there, you're the, you know, journalists don't, they don't want to go anywhere else. Because for me, I feel like, you know, what the work we should be doing is actually like getting more voices out there. You know?
Yes, I
so
agree.
So like choosing one spokesperson is very unfair.
Totally.
It's extremely unfair.
But this is why I wanted to talk about this very thing. We need to have more of that. You're right. We need to have, but okay. So now it's actually getting to where we need more of Viet Thanh Nguyen's, because why have one person on the thing? But how do we get more voices out there?
Well, I would say that we need more voices, but I'm not saying we need more Viet Thanh Nguyen because we don't need like replicas, you know what I mean? But what you're talking about is you're just talking about, you know, just need media in general to be able to find diverse voices within the community so that the community doesn't just look like one person, you know? I find that we're just talking about Vietnamese people, right? We're not talking.
Yeah, just Vietnamese people.
I see. That's a little that, yeah, but that is, I think like we're set up for that. We're set up, the only one person gets to be that, you know, and that goes to like, you know.
Who's we set that up? What do you mean by we set that up?
Well, okay. So media has set it up that the Vietnamese American community only has one voice, you know, and it's the same person they go to. And it's a big criticism about media in general is that it's lazy. They don't want to have to do any extra work, so they go to the same people. So there's no richness in that, you know.
Yeah.
It's not a fucking tapestry. It's a fucking photocopy. You know,
a monolith.
I mean?
Yeah, it's a monolith.
Yeah.
Now, and this is also what we debated. Did the media, did America media get lazy and only selected this one guy, or is this one guy designed? He designed it himself, and he is the only one because nobody else is designing it for themselves.
No, there have been studies that are like saying like, you know, like media, they're very, journalists are very lazy and they go to the same source. They couldn't pick, you know, and like it, for them, it's like, once you get quoted, it's more likely you get quoted again. You know, that's the problem when you don't have, you know, diversity, you don't have like journalists who are invested in having, you know, in cultivating a large pool of sources. So you just go back to the same source. Like, why is David Chang always like, they ask him about every something, you know, like, I like Chang, you know, but like, he doesn't know everything, you know, but they ask him for it. And that's a problem. And, you know, food journalism is very lazy about that stuff, you know, because it doesn't want to go beyond that. And that's why they like to create stars, so that they can go back to the same stars,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, it's like, not like I begrudge anybody about that, but you know, like that's the problem. It's like, you know, you get quoted and that's why like white experts get asked about everything. It's like, they don't want to like, MSG, let's go back to Harold McGee again. Like who there's so many fucking other people, you know? So,
yeah.
And they become the authority, you know, it's kind of this weird, you know, thing where like authority is given. And then once it's given once, and it has traction, you know, then, you know, like fucking Andrew Zimmern, you know, like fuck that guy. Everybody mm-hmm. fucking loves it. And I'm like, they call him the professor now. I'm like, have you fucking forgotten that he had this whole show called Bizarre Foods, in which he called other people's food bizarre, mm-hmm. and that he like patted himself in the back by the mere fact that he's able to you know, swallow it. You know, fuck that shit, you know?
Yeah.
But then he's like been able to like have this like authority, you know? And it's like, you know what? I've been able to eat balut since forever too. So, you know, like it's, so, yeah, you know, so I find that it is part of media. Like they go to the same sources again and again and again, you know? And then, Viet's very good about also about, you know, like bumping other folks and everything too. So
yeah.
It's like, I don't think it's like what Viet engineered, you know, but that is like how media plays out and how, you know, and then our part is like, how do you, you know, always encourage, or if not like shame me to like fucking go, you know, find more people, not find other people, find more people. Don't be so fucking lazy about the shit, you know?
Yeah, there's this, you know, dearth of voices. And I hope in the next, you know, 10 years that we could have 20 or 30 more Vietnam wins and Amanda wins and Bao wins and more trans and, you know, more Vietnamese names out there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. No, I mean, because again, I mean, that's what media does is like, oh, we need the next Viet, we need the next Amanda. I'm like, no, because these people that create their own lanes because they did something really extraordinary, you know? And so like what we need is we just need to find new voices, you know, in general, and not like kind of compare them to, you know, because, you know, is Ocean, you know, Ocean Vuong the next Viet? No, Ocean Vuong is his own person with his, yeah, you know, with his own voice, you know. He had this like fucking Instagram post in which he's like, he said he inadvertently channeled Short Round because he had like these glasses, and I was like, I fucking died. I was like dead. I was like, okay.
He's a funny dude.
It's laid me for sure. But yeah,
Ocean is a super funny guy. If you go back on one of his IG posts, he's like semi naked, and he's like all and the I can't remember what the caption is, but it's a really funny. He teaches and he, you know, he's his writer, but yeah, at the same time, he's got this identity that is, I don't give a fuck what you think, you know, and he's just out there and he doesn't care.
Yeah. It's reflective in his writing, you know?
Yeah.
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 And, you know, I had a conversation, you know, I had a podcast with him, and he knows so much about MMA, about mixed martial arts.
Mm.
Right. And I didn't know that. And then Bao Nguyen brought it up. He's like, you know, you should listen to this one episode, and he talks in depth about MMA and the science of. So we actually talked a little bit about on the podcast about his knowledge of MMA and why, you know, he talks about violence in one way, and then, you know, he's really into MMA, and you know, it's kind of all conflicting, but it's not. It all makes sense when he explains it.
Yeah, I can see that it wouldn't be conflicting. Yeah, so I appreciate his mind for sure, you know, and like the connections he makes, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Ban Chung Collective, right? Is that what you talked about earlier? What is that?
Well, it's this, you know, I started this. We just celebrated our 10 years, actually, or our 10th annual. But you know, when I came out. You know, going to theater was like just kind of uncomfortable because there's just homophobic people. You know, it's like an uncle who's homophobic, or a cousin say some snide shit. And the thing is that, you know, it's like that, you don't want to be throwing hands, you know? And then, you know, and it's always like they always nice on you, and then you always have to, you know, they fucking laugh at it, you know? And I'm like, the fuck, you know? It was just like every time, like, and it wasn't just that, but it was like Thanksgiving and, you know, Christmas, you know, like, just like, I fucking hated going there because it's like, you already fucking know who I am. Why the fuck, you know, what do you gotta fucking,
you know, gotta just hate.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Oh, you know, and like when I just got out of college, and I'm like, oh, you know, you don't have a job yet, maybe because your hair too short. Because at the time I had like crop hair, you know, like I had a buzz cut actually, you know. And I was like, you should shut the fuck up, is what you should do, you know. And so anyway, so I was just like, I just felt like, you know, there was a moment I was like disowned, and you know, and so like just it was just like really tenuous. And you know, it was like being disowned actually was the best thing ever, because you know, my grandma was like, you know, I don't know you no more. I'm like, okay, fuck that shit, and fucking wild out, you know. And I gave interviews left and right about, you know, like, because I at the time we were starting a Vietnamese lesbian bisexual trans a support group, and Orange County Registered interviewed me, and it says Deep Tramp from Orange County or Huntington Beach or some shit, you know. And they're like, oh my god, and she called me up, and I said, I thought you disowned me, you know. I thought you don't know me no more.
Oh, like, shit. So your grandma called you up after that happened?
Well, because she didn't even read English. So it was like one of my cousins or my uncle was like, you know? And I was like, you know, I'm like, look, you don't know me no more. So, you know, so then we kind of like, so she's like, you know, who abandoned the lamb, you know, and I was like, what the, I'm like, I'm queer grandma, you know, but she was like, she made me promise that I would not go on the record in the Orange County Register until she died.
Wait, did you make that agreement with her or no?
I did, because I'm like, I didn't really care about the Orange County Register, because yeah, she didn't say nothing about the LA Times. I'm like, I'm going to go on Orange County Register. It was like a one-off anyway.
But why did you agree to it, knowing that she disowned you? And why would you agree to, why would you appease her? That's my question.
You know, I mean, I guess, one, you don't know grandma. You know, she's like, she fucking wear you down. But then also, I was like, it was no stakes for me, because I didn't, you know, the Orange County Register was, the only reason I was on was that, and I thought it was also, disingenuous, you know, because I think I lived in Huntington Beach for a little bit, you know, but then I think officially my license, driver's license had it, but I was living in LA. But the Orange County Register needed someone who lived in Orange County so they can quote. And so nobody in Orange County at the time wanted to be on the record. So I'm like, okay, fucking use my name, you know? And they're like, I'm like, I don't live in Orange County anymore. He goes, but your license plate still says it, or driver's license still says it. I'm like, okay, I think it's a little, okay. But you know, like
just roll with it.
They need to corroborate and not like make it like no one really existed. So anyway, so for me, like if she had to like, I won't go on record in any outlets, I go, hell no, you know? But I didn't intend to have another article written about Vinny. I mean, the article's done. I don't think you need two articles on, like, especially what I did, you know? So, And I was like, sure, grandma, you know?
Did you guys ever make up and be good?
Well, you know what? You know, she's like, she was, you know, she would always say something about, like, when are you going back to church and all this other stuff? And, you know, and then I just said, like, at some point, you know, and when you get married, I'm like, dude, like, if you had seen me, can I have your hair? You know what I mean? Like, like, dude, anybody who's married me is a gay man, okay? Because it's just like, there's no way I'm passing as a straight woman, okay? she hated my short hair. And I was like, you know, I was like, grandma, will you ever accept me? You know? And then grandma's like, accept you? Accept you? I pray for you every day. And that was her form of acceptance, you know. It's like, you know, so I'm just like, okay, it's kind of twisted, but I see where you're going, you know. And I'm like, it's not gonna happen, grandma, but okay, just keep on asking. It's still gonna be a no, you know. And then she got dementia, you know. And so it was just, you know, like for me, I, you know, with grandma, you can never win an argument. You just kind of just like, for me, I just, like, even when I was younger, like, I never won an argument with her. I just sidestepped her. It's like, look, you know, it's like, she's not gonna change, you know? And then, well, you know, I could just see myself spending my whole entire life trying to get her to change, you know? But yeah, and she had dementia, and then, you know, and I really had to make peace with that. And like, you know, I went back every week just to kind of help her, like, bathe her and all this other stuff, because, you know, my grandpa was, you know, he was overwhelmed, and we had an attendant, you know, but that attendant was working like 24/7. I'm like, this is unethical. So I just like came once a week to like, hey, this is supposed to be your day off, and, you know, like official, so you don't have to do anything. So yeah, so I mean, we, you know, grandma was a difficult person. She was a complicated person, and but, you know, like it or not, I was, our histories are tied.
Yeah, and you know? Probably forged you to become who you are today.
In some ways, yeah. You know, like, as much as she didn't want me to be the heir of her legacy, I think I am, you know?
Yeah, yeah, you're really a tough woman, you're a strong woman.
She didn't want me to be her heir, but oh well, grandma. I sometimes think that when, like, you know, I think that, you know, I, in my head, it's like, you know, now, like, when you pass away. I don't believe in heaven or hell. I don't believe in the afterlife really, but if it's anything, it's like you just become consciousness and you kind of know everything. Yeah. And all the bullshit, like your earthly considerations, like kind of go away. And so I think grandma sometimes looks at, I go, okay, girl, okay, that's good. You know, grandma never can, you know, she not a young yet, like she like come do toy or like hung with all, you know, hung with all, huh? That's fucking high praise, you know.
Come with us, high praise.
You know what I mean? You know, like, yeah. I mean, like the first time I made a dinner party for friends of mine, like grandma just go around and go, okay, now you just, and she was just like call everything crap. You know, like good job. It was like, oh, grandma, just like go to your bedroom, go to your den, whatever. Like, you know, I'm 16. Like, okay, let me serve this dog shit.
Okay, Zip, thank you so much today. It's so, you know, heartwarming to hear all the stories, and heartbreaking in its own way too. You know, war produces all these kinds of different outcomes, and whatever's going on in Ukraine and, you know, Afghanistan, you know, this is the human condition happening over and over and over again. And thank you so much for being who you are and being such a huge contribution to our Vietnamese community here in Southern California.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure. And thanks for letting me not stay on point.
That's my job, is to make you.
I love it.
Thank you so much. And I will be talking to you very soon.
All right. Thank you, Ken.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcast. Thanks again for listening.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.